Okie dokie. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live on WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois, this lovely late January Sunday, 2006. Today we're going to be talking with one of the outstanding young journalists spawned by the internet, spawned by Air America, also in these times in the nation, David Sirota, who in addition to being a leading political journalist is emerging as a political visionary of sorts. And we'll be talking about his ideas, his new work, his articles, and his take on where this country is politically now and where it's heading. Join us today in Media Matters, but first let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
This year, the Congress is expected to take up a telecom issue that will determine the future usefulness of broadband connectivity in the United States. Central to this issue is a concept called network neutrality. This concept, according to Consumer Federation of America Research Director Mark Cooper, is well ingrained in U.S. legal and regulatory history, having first been applied to railroads in the late 19th century.
So if I wanted to move grain down from my farm to a silo and then to a port, the railroad was not allowed to discriminate against me, to say, no, I'm not going to move your grain. I don't like the color of your eyes or your skin, or you're competing with my uncle or my cousin. So they had to operate their networks in a neutral manner, a non-discriminatory manner.
In the early 1900s, Congress mandated telephone networks operate on the principle of network neutrality. But now phone and cable companies, most notably AT&T, Bell South, and Verizon, want to kill off this concept in favor of what they envision to be a multi-level internet. Under this principle, consumers would continue to pay for a fast connection, but websites and other online content providers would also pay a premium to guarantee fast transport over broadband networks. Cooper says a scenario like that would effectively turn the net into something that more closely resembles today's cable TV systems.
If you think about your cable system, the cable operator decides which programs get to be in that system. They decide, not the consumer. And that's what the telephone companies want to do.
The technology already exists to prioritize packets of data flowing over broadband networks. For example, packets associated with voice over IP telephone calls get priority over email traffic because of the real-time nature of talking on the telephone. Cooper thinks using this technology, called policy-based routing, will fundamentally change the way the internet evolves.
The next Google, the new guys, won't be able to pay this freight. So that they will literally strangle the flow of innovation that has been the lifeblood of the internet.
Cable and phone company lobbyists are working hard to convince lawmakers to abandon the principle of network neutrality in the broadband context. The FCC has already ceded its authority in this area. Chairman Kevin Martin says he'd rather deal with individual cases of data discrimination when they occur. The problem is that once such discrimination begins on a widespread level, it's very difficult to reverse. A first draft of telecom reform legislation circulated on Capitol Hill late last year contained language mandating broadband network neutrality, but on revision, that provision was removed. Mark Cooper says the concept has worked so well throughout history with old-school transportation and communication networks that it would be simply foolish to abandon it now.
We're making a set of decisions across all of these areas that will determine the structure of the way we speak and hear for generations. And sometimes we don't realize how important these decisions are. That's our job, to make people understand what's at stake. We can't have big corporations who own the wires deciding who gets to speak.
And it appears the majority of Americans agree. A recent nationwide survey by the Consumer Federation of America, Consumers Union, and Free Press found more than two-thirds of those polled worry about cable and phone companies blocking access to online content or being forced to pay extra for content they now get for free. A similar margin supports the concept of network neutrality, but less than half believe cable and phone companies will voluntarily adhere to this principle. The Senate's Commerce Committee will discuss net neutrality in a public hearing on Tuesday, February 7th.
Cable and phone companies are again trying to stifle the development of community internet projects in Indiana. Last year, a bill to completely deregulate phone service and ban public entities from building out their own broadband networks was defeated after cities, towns, and concerned citizens rallied to stop the legislation. But a new proposal would effectively ban the public provision of broadband unless a community agrees to undertake a cumbersome administrative process to prove that no private broadband options exist. In addition, this new bill would provide a host of tax and other financial incentives to entice cable and phone companies to expand broadband. These incentives, unfortunately, would most likely deprive local governments of property tax revenues.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live on WILL AM 580 Radio here in the heartland, beautiful Urbana, Illinois, January 22nd, 2006. Producer Andrew Boyle here, of course, and our technical director, Brett Polson, joining me in the studio. Today we have a terrific guest, one I've been looking forward to having, one of the exciting young political journalists and participants in the United States today. And I think dare say that if we lived in a society with a somewhat saner media system, he would be probably as well known as some great genius like Ann Coulter, but we don't live in such a society, so he is relegated to Air America, where he appears on the Al Franken Show a couple times a week and in these times and working assets in the nation. Our guest today is David Sirota. David, welcome to Media Matters.
Thanks for having me.
It's terrific. Now, where are we talking to you now?
I'm in Helena, Montana.
You're a Montanan now.
Yep.
Now, you're originally from where, if I may ask?
I'm from the suburbs of Philadelphia.
Okay, but you went to college in Northwestern, so you do have some Illinois roots in you.
Yes, I do, and I do not miss, I have to admit, I do not miss the winters on the lake.
Okay, well, down here, we're in the Sun Belt in
Champaign-Urbana,
right. So, you know, I just came in from the pool. I won't tell you which pool. Well, let's get right down to business. David, you are out in Montana because you worked one time on the campaign for now Governor Schweitzer. Is that correct?
I worked on both of his campaigns, his first race against Conrad Burns for the Senate in 2000 and then on his successful race for governor in 2004.
So you are a journalist and you have a lot of experience writing and doing broadcast work on one hand, but you're also a political participant.
Yeah, right. And to be honest, I make no effort to hide that. I mean, the difference between, I guess, the only thing I would say is that I'm a political operative in terms of sort of I'm more of an ideological political operative rather than a partisan one. Not that I have ever worked for a Republican, but I used to work for Bernie Sanders, who was an independent, and I basically base my political work on working for progressives.
And you are also an author of a forthcoming book, which is called Hostile Takeover. And who's publishing that?
Crown Publishers.
Crown Publishers. And I think it's going to be a major work. If only I went to Amazon to look it up today to get some information on it. And it's already ranked well ahead of all of my books in the sales charts. And it hasn't come out for 4 months. So that's not saying a great deal, but it's sort of depressing for me.
Well, I've been bothering all of my friends and relatives and people in politics to take a look at it. I think, you know, it was a lot of work, and the book basically is a citizen's guide to not being lied to by your corrupt politician. It essentially takes apart 10 of the major overarching economic issues that ordinary citizens face and shows how essentially corruption is not just about vote buying and bribery on those issues, but how corruption has essentially limited the overall debate on those issues to make sure that the outcome of any public policy debate is one that benefits big money interests and essentially screws over the middle class.
Oh, what don't we just talk about a couple of these issues, David Sirota, that are in the book?
Sure. I'll give you a good example. In the energy chapter, basically, it goes through and it sets up, you know, lies, myths, and half truths. You know, and it shows, you know, one of the lies is that we're led to believe is that essentially we have to let the market basically take care of our energy infrastructure and energy economy. And it goes through and literally shows how politicians of both parties basically continue to say that we must let market forces have proven to work, market forces must be allowed to work. Meanwhile, every single factual shred of information shows us that when we allow the unbridled market to deal with something as critical as energy, it basically has resulted in Enron and basically ratepayers being ripped off. So that's one of the issues. It goes through the bankruptcy bill.
Let's take a second here, because this is a work of singular importance that has come through Congress in the past couple of years.
Yeah.
And it sort of sailed through, and I want to talk why it sailed through, so without much public awareness.
Yeah, well, over the last many years, the right-wing and corporate-funded think tanks have pushed the idea that that ordinary citizens are basically abusing the old bankruptcy protections. They were, the myth. And this is repeated, literally, it's in my book, it's repeated by senators, congressmen, that essentially people are generally, ordinary people who don't need to declare bankruptcy have been declaring bankruptcy as a financial planning tool. And they've sort of created this myth of, if you remember, the sort of the Reagan welfare queen, mm-hmm. Basically this lie that, the system is being abused. And they use that rationale to pass a bill quite literally written by the credit card and banking industry lobbyists to essentially make it harder for people to get bankruptcy protections. Meanwhile, what got buried under the debate was the fact that basically 90% of people who declare bankruptcy after a medical emergency or a loss of their job. So in other words, the researchers who actually looked at the situation basically proved over and over and over again in a very airtight way that the myth that pushed this bankruptcy bill through the Congress was essentially a lie.
Our guest today on Media Matters is David Sirota. You've been listening to him. David Sirota is co-chairperson of the Progressive Legislative Action Network, a new group we're going to be talking about later in the program. He's also the author, I guess, out of blogger of davidsirota.com, a website I urge you to go to. I read it all the time. It's updated constantly and has critical analysis of politics and discussion of the issues we're talking about right now that'll be in his brand new book, Hostile Takeover, on corruption of policymaking and political debate on core issues nationally. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for David Sirota, the number here at Media Matters, 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. And David, what role on these two issues you just talked about and on the other core issues of public policy, in addition to things like bankruptcy, what role does our news media play in challenging this constrained debate? I mean, is it doing a good job as the fourth estate of saying, asserting a public interest that might not be heard if just left to the moneyed interest?
Well, I think on where the media intersects with this, it goes from at best to, I would say, decent coverage to at worst horribly biased coverage. You get the best form of coverage, which again I think is only what you could optimistically call decent, on issues that the media companies don't have a vested interest. So, for instance, on bankruptcy. There was some decent coverage of this. It wasn't great, but there was some decent coverage, and there were actually a lot of editorials against the bankruptcy bill. But then, if you go to an issue like wages, which deals fundamentally with an issue like trade, America's trade policy, which essentially almost every major multinational corporation wants. What is called "quote unquote" free trade, and that has been sort of this market, this free trade fundamentalism, and there's all sorts of data out there that shows that as America has passed these corporate written trade deals with China, NAFTA, CAFTA, that it has that those trade deals have done, have been a major factor in driving wages in the U.S. down, and that makes perfect sense. If a company knows that America's trade policy allows it to go troll the world for the cheapest labor, the most oppressed workforce, it basically undermines American workers' ability to demand better wages. This, even as corporate profits skyrocket. And so what you see in any coverage of trade, for instance, is essentially total market fundamentalism from the media. And there's actually, if people want to look, there's actually a very interesting example of this today in the New York Times, the Sunday New York Times. It has a piece written by a writer for the neoconservative New Republic. It's a review of a book by Gene Sperling, Bill Clinton's former economic advisor. I'm just going to read you a couple excerpts to just show you what kind of bias there is towards basically these corporate written trade deals.
Before you do that, sure. David, where in the New York Times did this appear? What section?
I'm not sure. It's right on the front of their politics website today. Their,
okay.
Their New York Times, www.newyorktimes.com/politics, you can see it. And basically, I'm just going to read you some excerpts. It says, quote, this is in the reporter's voice, "Democrats have little to lose and everything to gain by embracing the hallmarks of a dynamic economy like freer trade." Okay, what else it says? It says, while Gene Sperling appears to chide both sides, conservatives and liberals equally, his book functions primarily as a useful reproach to progressives who believe that ideological purity requires rejecting market-friendly means. Sperling's ideas are unfailingly sound. So this is basically, in the reporter's voice, it's the assumption that all of these trade deals, which polls show the American public generally opposes, which data shows has been driving down wages and eliminating good-paying American jobs, this piece, you read this piece, and it is assumed as fact that those trade deals have done exactly the opposite.
Our guest, David Sirota, today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. The number here, 333-9455, toll free, 1-800-222-9455. We have phone lines open, so please call in. Let's go to a caller right now if we can. Line 4, Eureka, you're on the air with David Sirota.
Yes, thank you. One of the things that troubles me about our politics today is, for example, in the House, it is my understanding that about 98.5% of the incumbents win. I wonder if you would know the figure in the Senate and if you would have any figures on state legislatures of how many of those seeking legislative office for the state legislature or statewide win just because of incumbency. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think that is a great question. You were actually the perfect person to ask that to.
The answer on the Senate in the 90s. The answer in state legislatures, in fairness, it basically varies from state to state. In a state like Montana, where I live, there is a part-time legislature. It only meets once every 2 years. And the legislatures really are basically citizen legislators. And there are term limits. So I don't know the exact figure. Incumbent reelection is still definitely above 60 or 65, 70%. But as you get to states that are more and more professional legislatures with no term limits, where essentially the politicians are professional politicians, the caller is exactly right. Incumbents, basically, the reelection of incumbents, it's again, up in the 80s and probably in some states the 90s.
And one of the issues, your blog, is you write about quite a bit, David, and I suspect it's in hostile takeover to some extent, is the importance of publicly financed elections. Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. It is in my book, and it is a critical reform. Basically, what we have now is you have a system where in order to run for office, you have to essentially rely on private funding of your candidacy. And that means that politicians need, for their political survival and political ascendancy, they need to go to big money interests and get money from them. And because, frankly, let's be clear, the big money interests, you know, people who are wealthy or corporate interests, they're the ones who have the money to, you know, the disposable income to spend on giving to candidates. And so what all of the reforms that we're hearing about now, the lobbying reforms, the ethics reforms that are coming out of Congress surrounding the Jack Abramoff scandal, they don't cut to the real problem that we face right now, which is that our politicians, their survival is based on a system of legalized bribery. The only way Jack Abramoff has been able to be such a powerful lobbyist is that he marshals campaign contributions to the elected officials in exchange for favors that he wants for his lobbying clients. And so you can change the rules all you want about how much a lobbyist can talk to or communicate with a lawmaker. That's fine, but unless you actually go and attack the problem of the lobbyist and the big money interest being able to basically buy candidacies, you won't get to the problem. And so that gets us to public financing. That's a system that's been passed in places like Connecticut and Arizona, where when you run for office, there is an option for a candidate to meet a certain minimum threshold. In some states, it's, you know, 50 contributions of $50 or less in every county in the state. And if you meet the minimum threshold, you get a percentage of a chunk of money that the state sets aside for publicly financing elections. And what ends up happening is that the candidates who opt into this system basically are independent of, or more independent of, big money interests. Their campaigns are not bought. They own their campaigns.
And what are the chances that we're going to get that sort of campaign finance reform at the national level, do you think?
I think if there's a serious push right now, I don't know if it can get passed through a Republican Congress. I do know that right now there's two Democratic bills. There's going to be a bill by Congressman David Obey and Congressman Barney Frank, which has one form of public financing. There's already a bill by Congressman John Tierney that is another form of public financing. And I think essentially what we can hope for now, I don't think in this Congress we can hope for passage, to be quite realistic. But I do think we can raise this issue to the national consciousness, put it in the national debate, get people thinking about exactly who their elections are bought and sold to, and really make this an issue. And I think that, you know, I've written about this. I've said basically, you know, Democrats right now, by not pushing public financing and by only pushing lobbying and ethics reform, they're creating a debate between the details of their ethics and lobbying reform package and the Republicans' ethics and lobbying reform package, a debate that people, it's hard to tune into. If they need to take a position that seriously contrasts with the Republicans, supporting public financing is a position the Republicans will never take, and it's a position that is very easily communicable to the public.
We're talking to David Sirota today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580. This is a live show, so the phone lines are open at 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. David Sirota is a political activist and journalist who has a website, davidsirota.com, which he updates frequently. He's a senior editor at In These Times. He writes for Working Assets and the Nation, and he appears twice a week on the Al Franken Show. He has a brand new book coming out in a couple of months, Hostile Takeover. We've been talking about some of the issues covered in the book by David Sirota. David, I want to get back to the phone lines in a second, but there are right now several major scandals in this country. There's no other word for them. There's the spying, the illegal wiretapping scandal with the Bush administration is now enmeshed in, the Abramoff scandal you've referred to. And I guess the third thing isn't a scandal, but it's the Alito nomination process for the Supreme Court in Washington. I'd like your assessment of these three episodes and of the press coverage of all three, what you've learned from it.
Well, what I've learned from it in general is that there is basically, you can see a worshiping of power, and I think that is the overarching thing that we've seen from the media, at least in the last 5 years, is that you can trace stories and the sort of coverage themes through the basically bowing down to power. And I'll just cite a couple of examples here. I think you see on the Abramoff scandal, for instance, you see the press not really bothering in an aggressive way the White House for details about its contacts with Jack Abramoff. And you also see the press going out of its way to try to claim that this is a scandal for both Republicans and Democrats, even though Democrats took no money directly from Abramoff, and the vast majority of lawmakers who are embroiled in this scandal are Republicans. Yet it's being billed as a bipartisan scandal, and no one is really aggressively pursuing the White House's connections. The only thing we've heard about it, really, in any real detailed format, is an Associated Press story in mid-2005, which noted that in the first 10 months of the administration, Abramoff and his lobbying team had over 200 contacts with the administration. That story has not been followed up on. I think you see this. I think you see this in the wiretapping scandal as well. You see that. You see basically the issue in the wiretapping scandal is not whether Democrats oppose surveillance on terrorism and Republicans support surveillance on terrorists. That's not the debate. Both parties, I'm sure most Americans, support some form of surveillance on suspected terrorists. The point is that this surveillance was done without the approval of a court order. So we see this. What we see in the media is a pro-national security, anti-national security debate, because that's what the Republicans want to ram it into, even though this is really a debate over following the law. And I think what's perhaps most amazing is that you see the media continue to portray it this way in every single format, even though we've seen a poll, you know, there was a poll 2 weeks ago by the Associated Press, which showed that when you ask the public, do you support the President of the United States performing surveillance on suspected terrorists without getting a court order, 56% of Americans oppose that. So the public clearly opposes this, and the media continues to portray this in a way that's totally inaccurate. And finally, I think on the Alito hearing, look, I think that the coverage has been somewhat decent, but I think it has also been basically, again, there still has been that vein of not really wanting to challenge power, not really wanting to get to the heart of who this guy is, and beyond that, what the implications of him on the court will be, not just on the hot-button social issues, but on the broader issues of executive power that are really at the forefront right now.
We're talking to David Sirota today, Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Please call in if you wish, 333-9455, toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Rankin, you're on the air with David Sirota.
Hi, guys.
How
you
doing? Sure. Doing great.
Doing fine. I was wondering if you could spell your name, David, so I could look you up.
Sure, Sirota.
Okay. None of this is new to me. I read a book by Ferdinand Lundberg called The Rich and the Super Rich. It was written in 1968, and his premise is that pretty much since 1918, corporations have been the shadow government of the United States. So you're doing your part to make us aware of what's going on. You're doing your job. What can us grunts on the street do to correct any of this? And let me say this last thing, and then I'll hang up, that when I write to Congress and I tell them how I want them to vote, they actually write back and say, well, I like this bill. I'm going to push it through anyway. So I'll hang up and let you respond.
Thank you very much. Yeah, David?
It's a tough question. It's a question that I get all the time. I would say that the most important thing people can do is really think about being a big fish in a small pond. I mean, one of my criticisms of there's been a lot of enthusiasm and excitement for the resurgence of energy among progressives. But my problem with some of that is that it focuses primarily on essentially the presidential election, these huge, massive elections that I'm not saying aren't important. They're extremely important. And I think that this focus on the very, very large is fueled in many ways by the consolidation in the media. And if you think about it, every time you turn on, you know, you get less and less local coverage of local politics, politics that actually affects you and your life in your backyard. And you get more and more coverage of only national politics, because essentially what happens when the media consolidates, as Bob, I'm sure you've talked about on your show, is that, you know, there's more national bureaus in Washington and less bureaus out in sort of America. So there's this focus only on the on these big, huge races. And what I would say is that for people really to get back involved and start taking their government back, think about how important and influential you can be in, for instance, your city council race or with your county commission. You know, you put 20 people, 20 active people in a room with your county commissioner and say, here's what we want. We want to know why you're going to support it or why you're not going to support it. You know, that person is far more inclined to listen to you or at least take into account what you want than if you go have a meeting, for instance, with your U.S. senator. And again, I'm not saying you shouldn't go meet with your U.S. senator, but the point is we've got to start acting really locally.
In fact, this leads naturally to a discussion of the Progressive Legislative Action Network, which you've just launched. I mean, it's just getting off the ground now. It seems premised on the comments you just made.
Yeah, well, I'll let everyone know about it. We're basically we are starting an organization to support, in many different ways, progressive state legislators. Right now, in this country, there is a very big but stealth focus by the conservative movement on state legislatures through many organizations, primarily one called the American Legislative Exchange Council. What these groups do is basically arm right-wing legislators with well-crafted legislation that is designed to essentially take over the states for the conservative movement. I'm just going to give one example. Last legislative session in Georgia, the Atlanta City Council had voted through and passed a bill to give preferential contracts, city contracts, to companies that paid their workers a living wage. So it wasn't even a living wage mandate. It wasn't even a bill that said everyone in the city has to pay their workers a living wage. All it said was city contracts will be preferentially granted to companies that pay their workers well. Well, ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, has a series of bills, boilerplate bills, called Wage Repeal Acts. And what happened was the Georgia State Legislature overrode and invalidated the Atlanta City Council's bill, basically used the state legislature to invalidate a local community's efforts to raise its own wages. That was done by ALEC. ALEC is funded by corporations that don't want to see a living wage, that want to drive wages far down as possible in order to maximize profits. So what the Progressive Legislative Action Network is going to do is not only going to fight back against that kind of stuff, but arm our legislators, our side's legislators, with legislation that pushes our agenda.
What percentage of Americans do you think could even name their state representative?
I think it's probably very low, and I think that that's pretty troubling. I think that as you go to states that are smaller, and this is actually an interesting thing to think about. I have found that the smaller the state you go to, the more in touch people feel with their legislators and with essentially all of their political leaders. I think one of the things that if you're talking about in the next 50 years, a way to really reform America is to, and this is sort of pie in the sky, but it's something interesting to think about. Think about it this way: how is it possible for somebody who, let's say, lives in New York State, to really feel any sort of connection to their U.S. senator? To state with tens of millions of people, the senator is trying to legislate for all of these people. There's just no possible way to feel in touch with that person. But out here in a place like Montana, you know, say what you will about Senator Conrad Burns or Senator Max Baucus, people feel like they know them. And so I think one of the big things that has really disconnected people from the political system is the fact that in the media age and in an age where our population has grown to a much bigger point than it was back when our government was set up, is that people really don't feel any sort of personal connection to the people who are supposedly representing them.
We're talking to David Sirota today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. We're coming to you live, so please do call in. If you have questions or comments and want to talk with David Sirota, the number 333-9455, the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Line 1, Champaign County, you're on the air with David Sirota.
Hi. I wanted to return to the Alito thing. Barack Obama was on a chat show this morning, and I missed the last minute and a half of his interchange with Russert, but he wasn't asked about Alito at all. And I know from people corresponding with him that he's sort of saying he's deliberating whether to vote for him or not, not whether to help with a filibuster or not. It seems to me just absolutely outrageous that that's the case. And we get the commentary from Cokie Roberts in her political checkup on Monday mornings, I guess it is, that outside groups are working to, you know, stem this apparent inevitability. And it's like, who are the inside groups? Is that the Federalist Society, because they have a lot of judges on the bench already? Is that what an inside group is? I mean, I just find it outrageous. It seems the kind of acquiescence and the idea that it's a done deal is sapping people with any intention to comment. And I think Barack Obama, particularly because some of the most moving testimony about Alito was about, to my mind, was voter apportionment and also law enforcement issues that Alito is on. I mean, you can put aside the corporate stuff, which maybe some of the people that have been appointed by Clinton were fairly corporate friendly too. So, but it just seems to me that Obama needs to feel a lot of heat, and it's just amazing that he doesn't even get asked a question on a chat show about something as momentous as a lifetime appointment.
All right, thank you. Yeah, David, what is your take on Barack Obama, in addition to this? Because I know you've worked very closely with candidates for Senate and House, and you monitor these politicians pretty closely. Is Obama, has he been up to snuff, in your opinion?
Well, I'll tell you an interesting story. I had written a couple things about Obama just on at Working Assets, and I had written about how in his first 6 months he voted for the corporate written class action bill. He voted against a piece of legislation designed to cap interest rates at a whopping 30%, and he voted for Condi Rice.
How did he vote on that bankruptcy bill?
He voted against. Here's the thing. He voted against the bankruptcy bill, but there was an amendment to the bill that would have capped interest rates, credit card interest rates, at 30%. Not exactly a serious cap. I mean, 30% interest is huge. And so he voted against that. And what happened was, which was very interesting, he called me. And I had also criticized him for basically claiming that he had been on the campaign. His words were a loud and vigorous opponent of the war. And at the time, it was about, 3 months ago, if you checked his website, his Senate website, there was nothing about Iraq on the website at all. Okay, so he called me up, and he, I was actually pretty surprised to get a call from him, and he said, I've read some of your stuff, and here's how I feel on the things you've criticized me. And I was impressed that he said, on two of the issues, on the war and the class action bill, he basically said, I've really thought about that, and it's been it's something that I respect people who on both sides, and I understand the criticism, and it's something that I've been thinking a lot about. And on a couple of the other two things, he sort of said he didn't agree with me. But I think really, and I'm going to be writing a piece about Barack Obama in The Nation in the next couple of months, and I think really what's going on with Barack Obama is, Barack Obama hasn't decided what kind of a senator he wants to be. He is struggling. If you look at who he's hired on his staff, for instance, he's hired all Washington insiders. In fact, the American Prospect just reported that, and I didn't even know this, that his top economic advisor was the deputy chief of staff to Robert Rubin, the guy who is the architect of all of America's, many of the worst free trade bills and worst neoliberal sort of economics that have driven wages down, et cetera, et cetera. And so I think Barack Obama has surrounded himself with people who are telling him, go along to get along. Your job is to simply be a good legislative operator. And I think he is struggling with whether to be that model or whether to be a model that uses his Senate office as a platform, like people on both sides, like a Ted Kennedy, like a Russ Feingold, like a Paul Wellstone, even like a John McCain or a Chuck Hagel. These are people who don't see themselves only as
needing to pass legislation, needing to go along to get along, but people who see their office as a way to raise issues that aren't being discussed in the political debate. I don't think we've seen that from Barack Obama yet, but I hold out hope that we will see it.
Let's go back to the phone lines. You're listening to Media Matters on WILL AM 580. Our host today, David Sirota, co-chair of the Progressive Legislative Action Network, blogger davidsirota.com, author of the forthcoming book Hostile Takeover, and frequent guest on the Al Franken Show and correspondent for In These Times in the Nation. He's got a long resume, but very impressive. Let's go back to the phone lines right now. Line 4, Charleston, Illinois, you're on the air with David Sirota.
Thank you very much. This is not off-topic. I don't think it is.
I don't think you can be off-topic today.
I'm sorry?
You can't be off-topic on today's show.
Okay. I'm putting in a plug for an organization that I think a great deal of, and the mention was made of some of the difficulty of finding out what your elected representatives are doing or thinking, or maybe get to them to try to answer a question for you. And this is an organization called Project Vote Smart.
Mm-hmm.
They have a website, www.vote-smart.org.
You know where they're based?
As a matter of fact, they have their headquarters is in Montana.
That's right. They're in Phillipsburg, Montana, about an hour from where I am right now.
Okay, and I'm just happen to be looking right now because I wanted to see what was there at the local officials of Champaign County, Illinois, and they have the names, addresses, phone numbers, fax and email addresses of all the members of the county board. They haven't, as far as I know, they don't have positions on anything published here with that organization, but it's access to them to know where to find them and where to ask them questions. They also, among their basic categories of information, have biographical information, campaign finances, issue positions on their national political awareness test, interest groups rating, voting records, and public statements of all of the legislative officials from the president on down.
Sounds like a terrific resource.
I'm sorry?
Sounds like a terrific resource.
It is absolutely fantastic. I wish more people knew about it and it got more publicity than it has gotten.
Well, thanks to this show, I think we tripled awareness. Do you have any questions for David Sirota?
Nothing other than that general, not necessarily to him. I think apparently he knows about it, but just for any of the listeners who might be interested in some place to go to find out some of these basic pieces of information
about their
legislative representatives.
Thank you very much. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Line 2, Lawrence, Kansas. Welcome to this neck of the Midwest.
Thank you. Back to public financing of elections. As I understand it, the largest cost of campaigns is media funding. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay, so if that's true, and then is the media still required to operate in the public interest as part of the cost of the public allowing them to use it for profit?
Well, that's an interesting question, and I think you're touching on an issue that I think hasn't necessarily, and I haven't read all of the details of all of the public financing bills being pushed right now, but what you're essentially saying is if you have a public financing system of elections, one thing that you end up doing is it becomes, in some ways, a public subsidy for the broadcasters. Right. So right now you have candidates who rake in private money from, you know, health insurance companies, oil companies, et cetera, et cetera. They take that money and they give it to the broadcasting companies to put ads on television. Okay. So that's one. That's what we have now. Public financing, if you look at it from that perspective, is you're taking public money. So at the very least, you're cutting off in some ways the reliance of a candidate on private money. You're giving them public money, so that's good. But what you're saying is that the public money is still going to enrich the broadcasters who make huge profits. So I think ultimately, in a perfect system, and what we should all be pushing for is not only a public financing system, but one that also, as part of that public financing system, gives candidates free or reduced rate airtime. Remember, as Bob, I'm sure you've told your listeners all the time, is that the public owns these airwaves, and it's the public licenses these airwaves to private companies, and it's the public, therefore it's the public's right. We can legislate that certain amounts of time on the air should be given for free or for reduced rate. And I think that, you know, one of the ways, because the big criticism of public financing is going to be, oh, it costs a lot of government money. We're going to give government money away to politicians. Well, if you think about it that way, what's the way to keep the cost of public financing of elections down? Well, you don't have to give a candidate as much money as much public financing if, as part of a public financing system, you require the broadcasters to provide free or reduced rate airtime.
We're talking to David Schroeder. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Line 1, Urbana, you're on the air.
Hello. This goes back to a couple of earlier callers, just about the one who called and asked, what can he do personally? And then the next caller who called to talk about Barack Obama. I think it's worth a phone call from anyone who's listening on the Alito thing to say, not just Barama, but also Durbin, and saying, look, this is the best time to filibuster. If you're not going to do it now, you're never going to do it. And why are we voting for you? I just wanted to throw that out there because it seems that idea hadn't entered the discussion is pretty crazy to me.
Well, no, you're exactly right. I should have said that. And I should also say, for voters' information, I think I'm about 95% sure. I read a story yesterday that said that Durbin not only said he's not going to vote for Alito, but is the one trying to organize potentially a filibuster.
Not surprising. I'm almost always impressed with Durbin and not Obama at all. But anyway, thanks.
Well, thank you very much. Let's talk a little bit about the Senate if we can, because I know you follow electoral races at the national level closely. You worked in D.C. for a long time before you got out into the heartland. We have Senate 2006. There's going to be, obviously, this year, the off-year races in the Senate with 30-some seats coming up, and the whole House goes up for re-election. Currently, both the House and Senate nationally are under the control of the Republican Party, which is very much advantageous for the Bush administration. It's prevented a lot of investigations from taking place, the sort of investigations Clinton routinely had to face because the Republicans were able to call them since they controlled the Senate and the House, too, during a period of his administration. What's your take on the importance of these elections this year at the federal level and what's emerging around the country?
Well, I think the elections are critical. I think that the 2006 elections are going to be a choice of whether to continue validating the current agenda being pushed in Congress and by the president without any check or not. What I'm concerned about is that the Democrats don't appear to be serious about trying to take back the majority. And I'll give you the best example of this, is that you have every Democrat in Congress screaming about corruption, 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 everybody. And yet, if you looked at the coverage last week about the lobbying and ethics reform packages, the media correctly pointed out that neither party is addressing the fundamental problem of money funding political campaigns. And so, and this at the very same time that you see polls show that the public thinks both parties are equally corrupt. Now, I can understand why the Republicans don't want to address the real problem. They're in power. They're the status quo. The less they can change things, the better. The fact that the Democrats, however, aren't pushing a real slate of reforms really speaks not only to not being serious about taking back the majority, but really to a troubling strain within the Democratic Party that really believes in nothing other than the party label. It does not believe in policies. I'm going to give you two examples. The first one is the House Minority Whip, Steny Hoyer. This is the number two Democrat in the House. Okay, here's a guy who is heading a party that's trying to make corruption a big issue, who literally has on his official Minority Whip website a story about him starting his own K Street project. And for people who don't know what that means, is the K Street project, K Street refers to the street in Washington where all the lobbyists work. And the thing at the center of the Abramoff scandal is a Republican scheme called the K Street Project to basically shake down corporate lobbyists for campaign cash. Steny Hoyer, a Democrat, a top Democrat, the number two Democrat in the House, has a story on his official website bragging about creating his own K Street project. So, of course, somebody like him isn't going to be for reform. Similarly, Rahm Emanuel from Illinois, from Chicago, who heads the Democrats' campaign committee. Here's a guy who again, running around talking about corruption, we're going to make corruption the big issue. Rahm Emanuel's campaign committee, his own campaign committee, is headed, the treasurer of his campaign committee is a corporate lobbyist who acknowledges having lobbied Emanuel on key corporate issues. So the public is not stupid. The public understands that both parties are corrupt. And until there is really an insurgency within the Democratic Party to finally say to the other pieces of the party, we are going to be serious about reform, I fear that the public just isn't going to be duped.
and is not. I mean, I don't actually fear that. I shouldn't say that. I don't fear that. I don't think the public should be duped. What I fear is that the party won't get serious, and therefore will continue losing elections.
Let's go back to the phone lines. Line one, Lombard, you're on the air with David Sirota.
Hey, good afternoon. I wanted your guest to talk about a little bit about the strategy of running Iraq war veterans for the upcoming elections. And in particular, one way that's played out where I live in regard to Rahm Emanuel is this Tammy Duckworth candidacy and how that's playing out with sort of the established grassroots Democratic candidates.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a big fan of your writing. Please keep up the good work. Big fan of Media Matters. Take care.
Thank you. Yeah. Iraq war veterans.
I think that, I tend to look at candidates based on what they stand for, because let's be clear. Ultimately, what you are voting for is a person who is going to vote on the issues. So really, no, I don't care if somebody is the most charismatic person in the world. I don't care if somebody's got the greatest story in the world, because at the end of the day, the only thing that matters is what they are going to do when they are in office. Whether, no matter how slick or smooth or what a great story they have or not. And so I think what I'm worried about when I see, I'm thrilled that lots of veterans are running as Democrats. That's terrific. I'm thrilled of that for policy reasons. I'm thrilled for that because, for instance, I feel that people, it's probably likely that somebody who is a veteran isn't going to continue voting for budgets that cut veterans' health care funding. So that's the way I think about it. What I worry about is that the party thinks that by running veterans, it doesn't have to actually deal with the policy questions that the party believes the veterans bring to the table. So what am I talking about? I'm talking really about Iraq. I think the party thinks that instead of having to actually take a position on Iraq, that it can run veterans and not actually deal with the issue. And so, and look, here again, I'll go back to Rahm Emanuel and Steny Hoyer. These are two people who, in the Washington Post 2 months ago, said that the party is not going to have an official position on the war. Emanuel at least clarifies that we're not going to have an official position on the war until the appropriate time. I mean, how much more could you reiterate to the public that your positions on war and peace are based on politics? I mean, that's just terrible. So what I worry about, again, the party thinks that by putting veterans up, it means that it doesn't have to deal with this issue. And, you know, I think we've seen it playing out in Ohio, for instance. You've got a Democratic primary between a progressive congressman, Sherrod Brown, and Iraq war veteran Paul Hackett. And everyone assumes that Paul Hackett is the anti-war guy and is going to carry the banner on that. Meanwhile, Hackett has changed his position five different times. You can look this up. He's criticized people for proposing a timetable for withdrawal, and then basically sent out an email saying everybody should support a timetable for withdrawal, and then went back to saying people who support a timetable are unrealistic. So, and Sherrod Brown, by the way, who is not a veteran, has authored the legislation to demand a timetable. And so what happens is I think that the public and especially Democratic primary voters need to really focus on not necessarily the story or the charisma or the style of the candidate, but where they stand on these issues.
David Sirota, we've got only a couple of minutes left, and we've got several callers who want to speak with you, so we're going to have to rush through these calls.
Okay, I'll keep it short.
Yeah, line two, Farina, you're on the air with David Sirota. The shorter, the better.
Hi. Okay, quickly, I just wanted to bring up, in the case of Barack Obama and his voting for Condi Rice, no one seems to have paid attention to his rationale, which mimicked Biden's right after Biden gave his, which was about, I disagree with you, but, you know, for Bush to have his family working for him. And basically that's my point.
Okay.
What you thought about that?
Thank you very much, David. What do you think?
I would say that most often when I hear that, senators are elected, and they are given in the Constitution the powers to confirm. And I find that senators, when they cite, the president is entitled to his nominees, they are essentially abdicating their responsibility. Now, I know people like Russ Feingold, for instance, have a more nuanced view of this.
my take on it is less nuanced, is that the Senate is elected, and one of their responsibilities is to be a check on executive power.
Let's go back to the phone lines. Line 4, Chicago, you're on the air with David Sirota.
Yeah, hi. I think I can make a case for my position, but let me put this to you. I think we're in dire times politically, and what we're presently facing is, to put it bluntly, fascism, and that the Republican Party is a neo-fascist or a fascist party, and no one seems to want to use that term. Do you have anything to say about that?
My response to that is that if you actually take the definition of fascism, which, as I understand it, is basically a centralized system of government, a command government that works on behalf of large economic institutions, I think that under that definition, I think you're absolutely right that the party pursues a policies that seek to use government power only to enrich powerful corporate interests. And let me just, not to go on too long, but as I mentioned in our trade policy, just remember, you know, everyone called it free trade policy, less regulation, right? Well, why is a trade policy, it's just one example, why are all of our trade policies 9,000 pages long? It's not because it's free. You could write a free trade deregulated policy on one piece of paper. The thousands of pages in these trade deals are protections, are using government power to protect specific corporate interests, most of which fund the politicians' campaigns who wrote those pacts.
Let's go to our final caller, Line 1 Champagne. If you could be brief, it would be appreciated.
Hi. I've been listening, and the only comment I want to really make is that I think that we need to be wise, get behind the Democrats. We can be. It always seems to me that we are always people who are not pure enough. There's always people who are not pure enough for us who are more liberal than they are. But we're now in a pickle here because we've tried to be so pure for so long. We need to get behind the Democrats and realize that we are facing a real threat to our freedom. And we need to support people and start moving them farther to the left if that's what we need to do. But they need to win, and we need to get out and support them.
All right. Thank you, caller David. We've got about a minute left, a minute and a half.
My answer to this, I don't think we've been pursuing purity. I don't even think we've been pursuing anything near purity. We've been pursuing split-the-difference politics. And if you look at the history of the ascendance of the Republican Party, they spent the time in the minority working to sharpen their positions. Every 2 years we hear the Democrats say, do not try to raise any serious policy issues because we have to think about the next election. And frankly, unless we start focusing on the issues, we will end up electing a Democratic Party that stands for nothing and represents almost no fundamental change to what we have today. And we can go back and forth on that, but that is the basic truth. And if you look at the history of the Republican Party, they followed this to a sturdy majority. And we must look back at history and follow the path of success.
David Sirota, we only have a few seconds left. I hear the band tuning up in the background, which means they're going to kick me out of here for Tavis Smiley. What are you working on now? Besides, you finished the book, I assume, and what should people do if they want to stay in touch with your work?
You can go to my website. I'm going to be writing a bunch of articles for a bunch of magazines, and you can take a look at the Progressive Legislative Action Network, www.progressivestates.org. We're going to have our new website up in the next couple of weeks, and that's what I'm going to be focusing my attention on.
David Sirota, thank you so much for joining us today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. And my producer, Andrew Boyle, technical director, Brett Polson. I'm going to be back here in 167 hours and 20 seconds, joining you next week. So until then, have a good week.